Awesome to welcome Ibaraki Robots head coach Chris Holm to the Basketball Podcast. Holm is a professional basketball coach with a diverse coaching background spanning collegiate and international levels. He's currently the head coach of the Ibaraki Robots in the Japan's B League, a position he assumed in June 2024 after serving as the team's assistant coach for 2 seasons. Before joining Ibaraki, Holm spent nearly 4 seasons with the Kyoto Aerons from the 2020 to 2024 as an assistant coach, helping guide the team through competitive B League campaigns. He previously served as an assistant coach at George Washington University from 2015 to 2019. Holm also worked in the private sector as a territory accountant executive with Toast Inc., further broadening his leadership experience. Hey, coach, a brief time out from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. Do you really know which plays, sets, and actions are working for your team? On offense, how valuable are paint touches and post entries? On defense, do you get more stops playing man or zone? Like high-level college and pro teams, you can use an analytics system like Hoopsalytics to get data-driven answers to help guide your in-game strategy and practice emphasis. With Hoopsalytics, you can track any action or set and see the resulting points per possession. Plus the video link stats, you can view your successes and fails and see if it's a play design or execution issue. And you can easily build organized film sessions from these video clips. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your game for free. Chris, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Really excited about it.
Pretty cool experience this past year. And before we dive into that a little bit, maybe just quickly shape for us, how did you end up in Japan?
After I was done college, I played overseas for about 8 or 9 years, spent majority of my career out here in Japan. I had the opportunity to get into coaching, so I decided to retire and did the coaching in college for a couple of years. Life took me on another path, and randomly during COVID, one of my ex-teammates, who was Japanese, that we retired the same year, he got into coaching out here. We stayed in contact. He got a head job, called me up, was like, "Do you want to come back out and coach out here?" And as opposed to sticking around and doing a sales job during COVID, we took the gamble and came back out here and have been out here for 6 years now.
And unique situation this year, you took over as head coach from being the assistant coach. So talk about that transition a little bit.
It was something that was like, it was finally due. I've coached for, like I said, 6 years here. I was 4 years in college. I felt like I was ready for the next step. But everyone always says, and it holds true, like it's totally different once you're in that driver's seat. And every decision is up to you, but it was a great challenge for me this year. Something I was, like I said, I was ready for, and life threw every possible curveball at me in year one. So definitely excited that I did it, was able to get through it. And I feel like I'll be a better coach on now that I got to the other side of it.
So now we understand the context a little bit. I think one of the cool things that we get to talk about here is how taking over as the head coach and then being able to go to management, go to your team, go to your assistant coaches and say, "Hey, listen, let's shift our culture a little bit." Talk to us about that. First of all, maybe that process of talking to them. And then secondly, what was the shift?
So talking to him, it actually worked out. The guy who took over as the GM here, he wanted to set up a defensive setup. When we first started talking, when I got the job, that kind of clicked, because for me, I'm a defensive guy. As a player, I was a defensive player. I was not like skilled offensively. My mind thinks from that side of the ball. And I just knew like we were one of the lower budget teams. And so from a talent standpoint and just like the juggernauts we go up against every game, I just felt that like in the last couple of years when we were offensive oriented, certain games when we're playing other low teams, we could be in the fight and we'll win some of those games. But every single time we played one of the top tier teams, we might make it a fight in the halftime, and then their coach going to halftime, give them a talking to, and all of a sudden they crank it up, and we'd 5 minutes into that next half, we'd be down 15 and the game would be over. I wanted to say, hey, let's try to turn things into a rock fight a little bit more. If we can shut them down, if we can make it a close fight, when the days when our offense is clicking, now we're going to have a little bit more of an advantage. And the big thing was just getting the players on board, I felt was the hard thing because we, again, being a lower tier team, like we were the last team to survive relegation last year. And we brought in or brought back two-thirds of that team. So to sit there and be like, all right, guys, we're going to completely change what we're doing here. I want you to get excited about it. And just as long as you give 100%, I promise things will be different. So the buy-in with them was probably the thing I was most concerned with.
So where did you start the buy-in with them? How did you start? Was it on court? Was it video? Was it a team meeting? Where did this whole process of changing start?
I started with our captain. Our captain had been here for 7 or 8 years. He's kind of like the city son, if you will. So I knew I wanted to talk to him, get him on board with what I was trying to do. And he was all for it. But after that, I really just showed the guys the numbers. Two things I showed him was one, where we stood. We were basically last in every statistic, every analytic defensively. And it was very simple. We can't win that way. The other thing was to just sit there and show a pattern within the playoff teams. The team that make the playoffs, they were always top half of the league in several of the major indicators: point per possession, offense, defensive rating, opponents' points per game, 2-point percentage, 3-point percentage. I was like, if we can start working our way towards that, is a huge starting point for us. And the big thing for me was management was like, hey, we want to get to the playoffs. I was like, let's pump the brakes a little bit. We don't even know what winning looks like. So what I wanted to do was like, I don't want to put a mandate on these guys year one. We're going to make the playoffs because they're going to sit there and look at that and be like, how are we going to do that? So I just wanted us to show them the numbers, say, we need to do the very best we can. We need to leave everything on the court. That's why I put like the 1% better. Every single day, we need to just get better from where we started. And at the end of the year of year one, we can now have some numbers to look at that are realistic to be like, now we got to get better at this. We got to get a little bit better at this. But now we have a direction to figure out how to win long term versus maybe we get lucky and win a couple games.
I love that. I love the way that you explain that and rationally explain that. And so that's the philosophy of your approach and of your change. Were there any specific tactics that changed, like defensively, where we forced, what we did defensively? Was that part of the change as well, or was it just more of an emphasis on that side?
I would definitely say more of an emphasis. There was a few little things we did. It wasn't anything crazy. We were able to bring in one or two guys that also had more defensive mindset. So obviously having guys who think defensively automatically made things a little bit easier because they understood what the assignment was. I didn't want to overemphasize with too many rules. I think guys playing with instinct, if we know the overall pattern of what I want to do, hey, we want to be getting into the ball. We have our certain assignments with scouts that you're doing this with this guy on DHOs or ball screens, you're doing this with this guy. But as long as everybody knows what the guy next to him is doing to where they feel comfortable and they're not overthinking things, that makes it easy for guys to just go all out. Let me just give my all on this possession because I know where my help's coming from on the left side, I know where my help's coming on the right side. And I think that guys just play better when they're instinctually comfortable. And so emphasizing and just pounding it into them till they felt that was who we're going to be. That was my kind of point of emphasis. Yeah, there was a few things we get in, throwing some junk defense and after timeouts, throwing in little things just to change the rhythm, or if I felt the rhythm was off, is another way to get the edge going for us defensively. But I really wanted to stay in man and just create a mentality of we have to earn it on this side of the ball.
It makes sense because it's in season as well. So there's not as many things as you could do if you had a whole training camp. We'll maybe connect that a little bit later and ask you what's coming for training camp this year. But back to your 1% better, which I love this philosophy, but and connecting that a little bit to instilling a habit of winning or understanding what winning is. So just connect those two things for us. What were some actual practical things that you did to help them understand that they were getting 1% better and that they were moving in the direction of winning?
I think the biggest thing that we did was able to just re-emphasize every single day individually where they're getting better. Guys who weren't playing, we're able to show them film of, hey, here's what you're doing before. Now look how you're incrementally getting better. You weren't doing this before. You're doing this now. You haven't gotten to the finish line with this. So then we're showing them film. Then we're getting into practice. They're knowing what they need to do to get better. And then you could see some of those guys at the end of the bench trying to like pull at that carrot, trying to get better at the things we need them to get better at. What that'll end up doing is then if the end of the bench is getting better, we can light a fire under them to force the guys at the front of the bench, the starters, to have to work harder. If they're just comfortable all the time, it's really hard for me to force you to get better because you're not going to feel that heat in practice. You're not going to feel that threat of my playing time. So that was one thing, is just competitive stuff. That allowed me to be able to sit guys when I needed to. That allowed me to switch up the starting lineup if I needed to. It just created a little competitive advantage for the coaches to be able to create the philosophy. So once that happens individually, where I can get them just wanting more, I could then show on to the team as far as like winning. All right. So early in the season, we saw some early success. We beat two of the playoff teams in our first four games. So now I have individual guys, I'm showing you what to do. Now team success is, look, we haven't, one of the teams we had never beaten in the first division since we've been here. So it's, look, here's as a team what we're doing. So those two are the things I did. The other thing was just showing, again, I would constantly show what our numbers were from the previous season and then kind of like tracking along the way. One of the things, for example, was I put out as a goal, 75 points a game is what we want to give up. I just thought that it was a good number. 75 should be, it should be something offensively we can attain. We should be able to score 75, but 75 keeps it under 20 points a quarter. If somebody does, if we do score 20 in a quarter, it gives us a little bit of leeway where it's like, hey, we tighten our belt the next quarter, we can stay on track. But the previous season, I think we had six games where we allowed teams under, or kept teams under 75 points. This year we were at 22. So it was like every time that number kept adding up, it was just another way for the team to see that, like, we're not always seeing the win, but the way we're losing is different. And then as the season went on, towards the end of the season, we played about 500 ball. We were finally starting to click. Everybody was bought in. They were clowning me every game. It was like, hey, we kept another 75. But you know what? They got excited. They got into it. And they understood that was one of the things that was getting us going the right direction.
I love that. It's such a great explanation. And obviously, it felt like it became their culture, their identity, probably in the second half of the year. And that's what shines through. Connect for us a little bit. What happened on offense then? You're taking over for a team that had an offensive identity. Obviously, you don't want to lose offense. So talk to us about how you handled that part of it.
Offense was a major roller coaster for us. So originally taking over, because I knew for us to change our identity, I was going to spend a lot of time in the preseason on defense. The coach over here previously, I'd worked for him for several years. Our offense was, it was not bad. It was middle of the pack. So I kept a lot of our offense that, because we had the same roster basically. They were familiar. They knew the offense in and out. I kept a lot of that offense just because I knew I can install it quickly. The guys knew the reads. They were comfortable with it. And then I could spend a lot more time on defense. And then as the season progressed, as we got more comfortable defensively, I could then get a better feel for our roster, like the new pieces and what we wanted to be on that side of the ball. Once I got a feel for them, I could adjust. I could add some things. I could weed out some of the other offense. But about a third of the way through, our best Japanese player, a big name we brought in as our starting point guard, he was our second leading scorer, our leading assist guy, leading 3-point shooter, towards Achilles. And that just major monkey wrench. So we normally would like to play fast. We call it robot speed, up tempo, play with pace. All of a sudden, once he got hurt, the game before he got hurt, our captain, who was an older vet point guard, he threw his back out. So all of a sudden, I'm playing this young kid who is, this is his first year in the league. He was playing in a lower league before, showed some talent, but had really not gotten a lot of minutes at the point guard. And then another kid who was more of a scoring two guard. That was the only other kid I could play at the point. And we went from, I think we were ninth as far as turnovers per game. We went to 24th in the league, like within 10 games. People just figured out, let's start pressing. They can't get the ball across half court. So we went into all-star break, end of December, January area. And we're like, all right, we got to change some stuff. So we had to slow things down because that's what those guys needed. I had to be smart enough to be like, all right, I want to play this way. We're used to playing this way. But that's not going to be effective for what these guys need right now. They need to just be able to survive. And so our offense slowed down tremendously. And that actually worked out with the defensive scheme, though, because we knew even more than anything, we were going to have to be in rock fights every single game because our offense just wasn't able to keep up.
Makes sense. And through all this, I'm thinking the importance of communication, which I know you've highlighted for me, is a really paramount thing for all of this to be able to communicate a new style, new identity, and obviously the improvement and all the different things that come with it. And obviously, the backdrop of that is in Japan, there's an interpreter by and large. You're not new to that, but talk to us about that process of communication and maybe some of the things that it teaches you having an interpreter about communicating.
I've learned I've had to slow down with my speaking. I tend to ramble in English when we're just talking to each other. We'll use slang, we'll talk quickly. The more you use, the more that gets lost. So you got to be a little more succinct when you're talking to these guys. But yeah, communication is absolutely huge because I think one of the biggest things that had to happen was I had to get everybody supporting the two Japanese guys, the two point guards that were taking over. We were losing at the time because our identity changed once that injury happened. And a lot of guys were like rolling their eyes because it's like, hey, these guys aren't good enough. We can't win games because they're turning the ball over. And it's look, guys, like nobody knew's walking in the door. This is the guys that we have. So we can either complain, we can keep losing, or everybody can try to like help do a little bit more, help support these guys to get them better now, get them going, get them stringing along. We're gonna lose, but we're gonna keep getting better. They're gonna keep getting better. They know the pressure on them. They know you guys are frustrated with them. They'll put in the work. And everybody kind of really got their backs. And our staff and a couple of the older guys, the guy who got hurt started constantly getting in these guys' ears, little lessons to be able to help them get the ball up the court, how to handle pressure, how to make some reads, everything. It was a all hands on deck. Let's get these guys better. And so I was really proud of it because slowly you started to see them show some light, get to the other side of the tunnel. By the end of the year, one of these kids, he won us some games. There was a couple games he took over at the end. He was handling pressure. He was fantastic. This was a kid that we brought in strictly as a locker room kid. He's a great locker room guy. His skill level was not there. And at the end of the year, we were like, hey, we want to bring him back. He's earned a B1 like contract. This kid has been great and he's the epitome of what we want to be. So just seeing everybody rally behind these guys, everybody was so happy with how the growth they showed. I think it really helped the team just grow into who we wanted to be. A future for our team having gone through that, I think is fan sky's the limit.
Well, it's great to hear. And coming into next year, I'm sure that's exciting part of it as well. Talk to us about using junk defenses. You talked about the structure of kind of the main defense. Now talk to us about incorporating junk defenses.
Yeah, in this league, we have a lot of really good coaches. So one of the things I like to do is out of timeouts, just knowing, hey, especially if I can get them to burn a timeout, I know that they're planning for something we've been doing. So the easiest thing is it depends on what we're gonna do, whether it's we're gonna trap the first ball screen. One of the ones I like to do is kind of like a three-quarter court, 1-3-1 that'll then shift. My college coach used a lot of 1-3-1. Then when I was at GW, it was the same coach. We used 1-3-1. I'm very familiar with it. I also know that it's a zone that not everybody has a 1-3-1 play in their back pocket. Everybody's got a 2-3 lined up in their game card. So it's just something that'll throw people off. It's also a high turnover zone if you do it right. And so the guys liked that one. They liked if you can get a couple steals, get some quick, easy ones, the guys will feed off of that and enjoy running it. Whether it was a zone, a trap, just something different. I always like to just throw something off, just change the rhythm. It's either A, you want to deflate them. You've got them on the ropes, they burn a timeout. Let's throw something up because the coach has got his one play to try to like get them back on track. If we can keep the wheels staying off the rails, that's going to help us. The other reason you use it is you're in trouble and now you want to kind of affect their rhythm. And depending on the game, depending on what their ability is, I'm going to throw one or two different things and see if it works.
Generally, one or two possessions only. And curious, like, how did you practice this again in the scope of the season?
So if it's the trap, it'll be one or two. By the time you get about a second possession in, they'll have the timing down. The way we break down for the trapping defenses is we'll do a breakdown drill where we'll send the back half, say it's just a middle ball screen we're working on. We'll send the back half, which will usually be like at least one of the bigs and probably the wing a lot of times in the league, they'll be in the corner. You're working on your rotations out of it. So a lot of times we're going for broke, we're trying to steal, get a steal. We got the full trap, and then we're taking away the next passes. So we're working on playing middle man, kind of like a free safety, if you will, and then full deny. The other side of the court, who's working on the trap, we're working just on our timing off, fighting off the ball screen, making sure the trap is tight. And then later in the game or later in practice, when we get together in 5-on-5, I usually like to get in mini games, 5-minute games, 4-minute games, whatever it's going to be. And then I'm going to dictate what we're doing in those games. So if I want to work just on trapping, it's like, all right, this team, anytime I want you going under on any ball screen off the wings. As soon as you go under, if they go under a rescreen, we're automatically trapping. So that way we can just kind of set the parameters, get as many of those reps in as we can, and it'll throw off practice enough. The one thing I hate is trying to get our team better and everybody cheats the drill. So at least if I can throw in something to hide it so that we can get some real life reps in, that helps. So I usually like to break it down, bring it in live, and then just try to keep the guys from cheating the drill so we get the most out of it.
Love it. Great example there in terms of that. And I love your phrasing as well. Defense starts while we're offensive rebounding. Talk to us about that.
So yeah, so we I want to try we're not a very good offensive rebound team. We've never been, which is weird for me. I was an offensive rebounder. Offensive rebounding is the hardest thing to teach because I think you can get shooters better. I think you can get point guards better at reads. Reading the ball off the glass is it's I think it's just an inherent gift. Some people just have this natural knack to see where it's going. And then on top of it, rebounding's you got to be willing to just outwork people. And not everybody is. Not everyone's willing to like get hit and keep going. One of the things we do is a couple teams that have Australian coaches here, they do the tagging up like 5-man. We aren't really built the right way for that. We're not as big as some of those other teams. Being a lower budget team, we have smaller guards. And if you're going to do that tagging up, sometimes the guy you're tagging is going to be a 4-man, and that's your point guard. So all of a sudden you have a massive mismatch on the other end of the floor. And I didn't want to do that because I feared the disadvantage on that other end. And so all we end up doing is our bigs below the free throw line, or if it's a three below the big three free throw line, they're going to crash. They're already down there, especially if you're in the paint, you are setting up shop, you're trying to get the ball. Anybody who's in the corners, you are trying to corral your guy to that elbow. And so as those other three guys are trying to get rebounds actively, you're now corralling your defense. We're trying to get as many of those defensive players who are going to be going on the offense into the paint. One, it allows us to get more opportunities with smaller guards to try to get those long in-between rebounds, which they normally won't get. The other thing it does is it limits the other team's fast break. And so we always will be right in front of our guy. It allows us to kill the transition offense from the other team and just gets us started. It gets us some inherent like pressure. So if I've done a great job, I brought my guy to the elbow, he ends up getting an outlet, but I'm already in front of him. Now I've got 75, 80 feet of pressure that I'm now putting onto them. I'm killing their transition offense. And now I'm naturally just getting in that grind of trying to heat the ball up, which is your defense is always going to start with on-ball pressure. The better job you do, the better job that guard does of just heating things up, the worse their offense is going to be. And so that just naturally was something I wanted to try to do for our team to get us into that defensive mindset.
So interesting hearing that, and then maybe interesting getting your perspective on tagging up from the perspective of playing against it. Usually we've had coaches on here talking about executing it and running it, but playing against it. What are some things that kind of you've learned playing against it that kind of maybe can help give you an advantage playing against it?
Is if you're playing against it, if you have one or two guys that can get the rebound, if you have a natural good rebounder, just like I said, what we don't like, if you have a five that's going to get the rebound, if you're playing against it, just leak out for fast breaks. That killed us when we tried, like 2 years ago, we tried doing it. And one game made us completely scrap it because they probably scored about 20 points in transition just because they had a 7-foot big. He was a phenomenal rebounder. He got every single rebound, and he literally just turned quarterback to their 4-man who was pinning our point guard under the rim. And so we scrapped that right away. And that is the best thing to do if you're playing against it, is if you can have a guy that can get the rebound, everybody else just get out. Because somebody's going to have a mismatch. And if you have a guy, especially a guy who's a good scorer in the post, You should be able to get one pass, two pass, push it down the sideline, quick feed. One of the bigs is always going to be on the wrong guy. He'll be with some guard somewhere, and you're going to be in transit. If you're not getting a shot right away, you're going to force them into a baseline trap. They're going to have to trap in the post, and next thing you know, you're getting into quick kickouts, easy threes. That was the quickest thing that I learned going up against it.
Yeah, I love hearing that perspective. That's really cool to hear.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know, the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable, and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com. Contact page or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
And shifting a little bit to the offensive side, talk to me about the phrasing, deliver a player an open team shot, and what that means. I just love the phrase, deliver a player.
Yeah, when I looked at it, like we don't have the national team guys. We have to try to create open shots for guys that aren't necessarily have the biggest bag of being able to create shots for themselves or for other people. So we do, I've heard million times, I've heard guys say it on your show, you try to create blender. We get an advantage somehow. Usually it's from a ball screen. We have our center, Eric Jacobson, is probably one of the best ball screen guys in this league. He will get our guards open. Once that advantage is created, we're looking to get the blender going. So you're going to get feet in the paint, kick out to your teammate until we find a great team shot. The biggest thing that's been a hurdle for me in all the years I've been in here in Japan is not everybody realizes I'm the recipient of the blender. We've gotten feet in the paint. They've overhelped. My point guard kicked it out to me in the corner. And some guys think, oh, I got to keep going. I got to keep the ball. And we've just worked for 15 seconds to create that shot. You've put the work in practice. Don't overthink this. Like, you feel like you're open, let the thing go, man. Let it fly. If you miss it, I don't care, because all we're going to do is keep trying to go to find an open shot. And there's no promise that we're going to get another open shot if you pass this up. And that's probably the biggest thing I've tried to teach these guys is, you need to kind of just get the feel for it. If you're open, just let it shoot. It doesn't matter if you're a 26% shooter, honestly. Like, if you're wide open and you pass this shot up, more often than not, and there's tons of film to show it, we end up taking a worse shot than you wide open just because you pass it up and we couldn't get the blender going again. So talk to the guys all the time. You put in the work, we take shots every single day. You probably take a couple thousand shots in practice every week. Doesn't matter if you're going to make it or miss it, but you have to take it for your team.
It's a common theme throughout this podcast over the years that, like, I think people assume maybe that's just a high school problem, a college problem, but it's all levels of basketball, the same challenge, right? To get certain guys to shoot when they're open, and then that's a good shot for you, but it's also a good shot for us type of mentality.
Yes.
And it's just amazing how that happens at all levels, isn't it?
It's mind-boggling, to say the very least, because it's, you know what it is. I feel like I know what it is a lot of times. It's a lot of times it's the guys who there's a little bit of self-doubt, whether it's I missed a shot early in the game, or maybe it's a guy that doesn't play a lot and he's, oh, if I miss this one, coach is going to take me out. I tell the guys all the time, I will never take you out for missing a shot. As long as if you're doing step backs with two guys on you, then we're going to have a problem. But if our point guard came off a ball screen, he kicked out to you and there's nobody near you, I'm going to be more upset if you pass it up. Because that is your time to knock down that shot. He did all the heavy lifting. Just take the shot. Don't overthink it. So the only thing I can say to the guys, just I say it all the time, be confident. You put in the work. Don't overthink it. Just be a basketball player. So
talk to us then about part of that. This connects to that is obviously the goal of shooting 9+ threes a game, but also finishing higher up in assists per game. So those two things obviously relate to what you're trying to say there, which is shoot the right shot, the open shot, because we might not get a better shot in that
correct
possession.
Yeah, no, correct. We won't. A lot of times, and again, film shows it, film don't lie. so many instances we'll pass up a shot and it results in either a bad shot or a turnover. And that's the reason we just pump it into their head. You have to take the open shot. And so the 9+3s is basically creates two things. Is one, in this league, this is not a great shooting league. Majority of the league is shooting 34%. Not a whole lot over that. There's probably three or four teams that are above 37%. We're not a great shooting league, but teams that make the playoffs are making over 9 threes a game. So we, again, looking at those statistics, we want to be one of those teams that are doing that. We've been really close, 8.5 or 8.6, I think this year we shot 31.6%. But the thing is, if you're knocking them down, if you're making 9 threes a game, that's still going to inherently make that defense want to close out to you. So if they know that you're at least willing to take the shot and the fear of making the shot, that's still going to create the driving lanes. And eventually, even if one of the guys we don't, I don't want to say don't want to take a shot because they're allowed to take a shot with me. But if a guy's taking 27%, just made one, now all of a sudden his defender closes out harder. That might open up our guy shooting 38% because his defense now, per his team rule, has to come help. So we just want to make those shots or take those shots to create the same rotational rules that their defense is predicated to do.
Did you do something to acknowledge that for players? Like, even though they maybe missed the shot, that it was still a good shot? Was there certain ways that
Oh,
you might?
absolutely. We'll show that on film. Team shot a lot of times, especially so we play back to back Saturday, Sunday. We'll constantly show on the Saturday or the Sunday before games great ball movement that leads to an open shot. A lot of times, what we'll end up doing is we'll clip it before it hits the rim sometimes because it doesn't matter that it missed. The point of emphasis is you guys did a great job moving the ball. You were shot ready. You let that thing fly. That's all we're looking for. Our job as coaches, your job as players, is to just create great team shots. We're going to have to live with the fact that some days the shots aren't going to go in, but we can't control that. We can control our focus on trying to create the open ones, and then the basketball gods will dictate the rest.
Love that. The basketball gods are hopefully always on your side, Chris. That's such a huge part of this. And you mentioned dialing back transition a little bit. So I'm curious, in addition to saying creating advantages, what were some of your favorite ways to be able to create advantages with this team? Dialing back transition, maybe more reliance on half court to be able to get players in the blender. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we actually had to play in the half court a lot more. We went from prior to our point guard getting injured, we were actually number one in the league in transition points. By the time the season ended, I believe we were 14th out of 24. So we had to slow down significantly. We ended up having to do a lot more in the half court. Plus, we changed rhythm. Another injury ended up happening. So we went from having a stretch four, a big, and a playmaking four to two true non-shooting bigs and a stretch four. So we again constantly changing all year long on the offense end stuff. The thing that we had to do was be able to look on paper like, what do we have? What can we do? When we had our stretch four, he was like the main focus for other team scouts. So we knew that, hey, we can involve him with stuff. They're not going to help. That was a great way of creating an advantage because the thing that was hard is he's a scorer, and I'm like, look, you're not always going to get the shot because they're so focused on you, but you're going to open up shots for other guys. So we try to expand his game because he was strictly I'm looking to score. Not in a negative way. That's just he was a hired gun. That's his role in international basketball. Towards the end of the year, he did a really good job of being a bit more of a playmaker. One of the combinations that was absolutely amazing for us. We had a Japanese two guard, had a career year, really good shooter. We put our four play our stretch four, and we started making him more of a ball handler, and we just went to 4-2 ball screens. It's not something people are used to guarding. If you have a really good ball friendly four and a really good shooting guard, 4-2 ball screens are really hard to guard for people because guards aren't used to being in that side of the ball screen. They're used to being pressure on the ball, not necessarily having to go out and hedge and then get back to your guy or that whatever your defense is going to predicate. The other thing we had was two fives that were phenomenal screeners. We got into Gortat screens was a great way to get guards open. Guards who aren't great finishers, our guards are not great finishers. We had two huge fives that basically just cleared the runway for them. So we tried using that a little bit more. A lot of zoom actions. And as teams started like pressuring us a little bit more, we'd sprinkle in a little bit of some a light Princeton action. We got really lucky where two of our bigs are solid passers, good decision makers. And we had, like I said, we kept that offense from our previous coach. We had a group of guards who had a really good feel on those split actions, when to cut, the timing, setting it up. That just made life easy for pressure releases for us.
So you talked about
I
the
know I just threw a
improvement.
lot at you.
Yeah, no, I love that. I want to go deeper with a few of them. And the 4-2 ball screen, particularly, you mentioned it being an uncommon action. I imagine that most teams ended up switching to a certain extent with that.
No, and that's the thing that's a beauty is Japan is so weird where a Japanese three man, you go to Europe, you go to the NBA, a three man is 6'6". You might find some 6'7", a lot of them are 6'5". Japanese three man is 6'1", 6'2".
So
You
big
see
size
something that's
difference. Yeah.
a huge difference. So you see something here that it's you're seeing it a little bit more in place. You'll see in the NBA. I know Embiid a couple of years ago, the nail post-ups are huge out here. Because you can't really double at that spot real efficiently. And if you're going to switch with Japanese guys, you just get your four, your five man, whoever it is, stick them at the nail and then just space out, let them go to work. It's really hard to guard. And so you don't see switching a lot here. So if you have a ball friendly big and a really good shooter, it's a tough action against the team that's not going to switch.
So that makes it even more powerful to be able to do that 4-2. What
Correct.
were some of the ideas? What were some of the ideas to defend that you saw?
I mean, you will see switching, and at that point, what you end up doing is you kick it out, let your man get settled at the nail, and then everybody space, get it back to him. And the big thing is just being able to play slow. A lot of bigs that get out here, they just want to get it, rip and go, just be a big guy that they see a meal in front of them, a small guy. Problem is they're really good at taking charges. So you got to play at a slower speed, set your guy up, get an angle, get downhill, and you'll score all day long. But you got to have patience. And so, guys that just get here, it takes them a little bit of time to learn the league where you can't just be a bull in a china shop. You're gonna get an offensive foul. But once you learn to play it like a YMCA old man pace, you can score all day long. Blitzing is really the only other solution we've seen. And so, the problem is if you have a four man ball handling, if you're gonna blitz with two small guys, he's gonna see right over the top. And then you're gonna create a rotation. Either everyone's going to stay at home and your best shooting guard has a wide open look, or there's going to be rotation. There's going to be a long closeout where, again, we've now gotten our blender going.
So I love hearing about this, the nail post up. I can picture that, certainly watching games over there. But particularly for a lot of, say, American coaches dealing with switching and stuff like that. And the tendency now is to attack only from the perimeter and not go to the post because sometimes it takes too long to develop that. And one of those solutions is the nail post up doesn't take as long. And that's why I think you're seeing in the NBA and stuff. Can you give us any insights in terms of that, in terms of how to execute that specific coverage solution, that specific attack?
The best way to get into it is a simple middle step up ball screen. It's a really tough angle if you're going to try to do anything else. If you're going to switch and you're coming out of a middle ball screen, the guy's going to have to automatically go on the low side. If he stays on the high side and there's a switch, you now have a small guard with a big baseline side. So there is no recovery. Everyone's going to have to help. You're going to have to shrink from the corners, which is going to open up additional open shots. Simple middle ball screens are the easiest way that we use it consistently of getting that switch action.
Love it. And
We very
Gortat
simple.
Green, something you mentioned, we've got to dive deeper on that. Some of the technique and some of the timing parts of the Gortat screen, particularly for your bigs in terms of understanding it.
So we have two different actions that we'll end up doing. One's with the simple, say we have our four-man shooter. So in that instance, we're going to end up with a four in the either probably four in the wing. Corners will be filled with guards. We'll run it with, say, our point guard, for example. He'll come into the simple ball screen. The big thing out of this is your guards need to be able to be strong enough to get that other guard on his hip, hold him there for a second, but he can't outrun the big. That was when we first installed it, our guards would get past the big and then try to almost go backwards to get, and it doesn't work that way. You need to be able to be in second gear, give your big a second, and then let him do all the heavy lifting. You know what I mean? And especially in this league with the smaller players, if you give him time to do that, he's going to clear the way for you. So it's just being patient. So young guards are probably the hardest thing of trying to get them to understand it because they just want to go. So two, as you can imagine, are two guards that took over once injury happened. Them being able to slow down to understand and see it took some time. Once they were able to slow down, wait for it, we had tremendous success. The other thing we had, which it's not really a Gortat because Gortats, like I just explained, that 5-man sets of screen just wraps around, is we'd have a side ball screen, clear them out. And then a lot of times you see the formation where you have a side ball screen, you'll end up with another big that's going to be the weak side dunker spot. We just basically waited off the side ball screen for the guard to turn the corner, and then you can clear out that low man in the dunker spot because he's going to be low man help. So basically, you're just like almost like an offensive lineman walking him to now what's going to be the weak side block. So just basically walking him across the lane that eliminates any help. So we were able to use that kind of as a second layer Gortat, where again, we were able to see a ton of success for our guards who inherently were not great finishers. They're smaller, they don't do great in traffic against physicality. We're now basically in the middle of a game giving them a clear runway to basically just do a layup line layup. Our guards went from, I think it was 40, our 2-point percentage last year was 43%. This year we were 52%. So we made a huge jump in our 2-point percentage this year. And a lot of that I do attribute to that kind of Gortat action.
So I'm curious because I know I get asked this all the time about that. Oh, it's a foul. It's a foul. And I'm like, it's a foul if it's called a foul. But the reality is, it's not if it's not. But simpler than that is like the argument back to an official, generally, I've always felt is basically it's just like sealing. Like you're sealing in the post to get the ball. There's literally no difference. But I'm curious if you have any other kind of common sense explanations to counter the argument that it's a foul.
When it's happening to me, trust me, I'm always arguing it's a foul. But
Of course.
the biggest thing that I sit there and say to our guys when we were put installing it is you don't need to go and hit them. You're basically hug, like you just walk in, hug them, and move them across the lane. As long as there's not this, what refs look for is that immediate knee-jerk reaction, the next snap, them getting off balance. If you just walk into them and start walking them across the paint, there is no knee-jerk reaction that the ref's going to see as like a telltale sign to make the call. So you don't need to do this explosive screen. You just need to be a people mover. So that was the big thing, is it doesn't have to be this impactful thing. You don't, a lot of times, especially in this league, is new bigs, first year bigs, I tell them, like, you don't need to, like, in the old school style, crack a guy on a screen. You just need to reroute them, and you're still a great screener. And so just getting them out of that, I need to crack somebody, that doesn't necessarily make you effective. So it's just being smart with your with what you're doing.
That's a good point because you referenced you had two fives that are good screeners, and I'm imagining that's part of it, right? Like the concept of actually making contact nowadays is not as important as you said, rerouting them.
Yeah. No, we teach a lot of it's weird. Honestly, from when I played, the rules are different in the NBA as well. So you have to be able to change with the game. Like you're able to touch the guards a lot more as long as it's not again, knee, I use knee-jerk reaction. As long as there's not this violent movement, as long as you don't see them violently move off their path. So I honestly teach if they're going to open roll, they can open or close. It depends on what their feel for what's happening is. The bigs can make their choice. If you're going to open roll, you can actually kind of two hands on the guy, steer him. You can push him up a little bit. Again, it can't be violent. You got to get a feel for it in practice. But you can put two hands and steer them. And it, especially if you're a five and it's a point guard, you'd be surprised at how easy it is to redirect him on the backside of our guard. And that's literally all you need to do. You need to give the guard a little bit of an advantage. You can also, if you're going to close roll, you can just use your inside hand and give him a little hip bump. Just give him a little push, and it looks like you're just leaving as a big man. And that again is going to change his path behind our guard. And you've done your job. You didn't crack him. You didn't set this like level screen where the kid's on his back, but you've done your job. And that's all you need to do because now the big has to get in his coverage. And now we have our 2-on-1.
Talk to us a little bit now. You've been through this process. Obviously, you've had success. It seems like it's all going in the right direction. And now you get to have a training camp. You get to obviously be involved in management and signing the players that you want. All these different factors that come into going into your second year. What are some things that are on your mind to keep this going in the right direction and building, as you said, on the 1%?
Yeah, so for this second year, I'm excited because I do think that we built a good foundation. My biggest concern is staying healthy now. We'll have our guy coming back from his Achilles. Constantly, my head's freaking out. Like I'm watching him in his rehab, and it scares the heck out of me. Like every time he's doing something. But if we can stay healthy, we'll have some guys. We added a few guys. We'll have some weapons. The offense should naturally improve just having all those guys there. Our defense is what I'm excited about because I know I put a lot in with the guys. And now, since the majority of the roster's back, and then the three pieces we've added will help us. I'm excited the fact that like we should be able, similar to what I did with the offense last year, where we should be able to hit the ground running. And now I can tweak and add a few other like layers defensively to give us just some additional weapons. So now we can grow even more. So now we saw what we can do. We saw what the effect of like buying in on what we want to do is. Now we can say, let's see how far we can take this thing. Let's get even better at this and this. Like I talked about talking to management about like we need a baseline of what we're good at, what we still need to get better at before we can start winning in a long-term conversation. So I have all our numbers from last year. I can say like we need to get a little bit better our turnover percentage. We didn't turn the ball over enough. Like when we're on defense, we didn't force enough turnovers. I want us to get in that top 12. We finished, I think, 16th. All right. That sounds a lot better of, hey, we just need to move up four spots. So let's force three more turnovers a game. That sounds a lot different from we're 24th in the league and now we got to get to top 10. That's a lot different picture because now you're like, all right, how do we fix that? We got to change everything. I don't need to change everything. I need to fix a few things. And I think that the guys, knowing we're healthy, knowing that they're going to get what I'm trying to do, they know what to expect and what I'm expecting from them. I feel like we can take a huge step this year. And it's always going to start on the defensive end with me.
We got that impression throughout the podcast. That's definitely a big part of it, and which is awesome because, again, they needed something different. And I love that whole connection to the fact that if we keep doing the same thing, nothing's going to be different. And coming from a place of almost being relegated. How many teams in the league? And then how many teams get relegated? How many teams make the playoffs? Just for coaches that are learning about the Japan League a little bit.
So they're starting a new league next year. So this year, typically there's 24 teams. They killed relegation for this year. So there will be 26 this year, and 26 will start the new league next year. So there's Japan basketball. It's a great time to be involved in Japan basketball. Again, I played out here from 2008 to 2015, and nobody wanted to play in Japan. And now you have NBA guys trying to get out here. You have Euro, like I've seen more Euro League players signed to Japan this year than I think I've ever seen in my life. Like it is a
The
great time.
investment in money and coaches as well has been noticeable over the
Yes.
last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to think of it before we got started. There's got to be 8 or 10 national team coaches in this league at this point. Like it is a really good time to be in Japan.
And what do you contribute that to? Is it just, again, Japan's more into basketball, more investment in this league? What is changing it?
100% investment. You're seeing way more money involved, bigger companies getting involved. There's TV rights now. And the game from like Japan, they go nuts for sports. But again, when I play, basketball was always like the younger brother to baseball and soccer. Basketball, no one's ever going to beat baseball here, but basketball is like having its moment. The national guys, the Japanese players, like you saw them in the Olympics last year, like they're starting to make a splash. Their Japanese players are getting much, much better. You're getting guys that are coming home, like Yuta Watanabe came home and he's playing in Japan again. That's bringing a ton of people. Like they're getting 10,000 people a game. It's an incredible number for a Japanese team to have that many people come to games. So it's just everything you need to make it special, it's all happening at the same time. So it's an incredible time for this league.
Incredible time for the league and incredible time for you, Chris. Congratulations on your initial success. And we can't wait to keep watching. And I know a lot of people will get their first impression of the Japan League, but I have an edit on our YouTube channel that's done very well. People are very intrigued by the league and the different styles of play and all the different players that, as you said, are going into that league as well. So what a great time for you to be involved and to continue your involvement over really a long process of playing, being an assistant coach, and now a head coach. So congratulations on that. And thank you for sharing the game with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.